Accession number 16808, Reel 18.
Reg Spittles, Reel 18.
Yes, so I arrived back at the night, during the night of the 29th of July. And as I say, I got my crew to come back. Well, apparently what had happened, they'd been in action with the 15th Scottish under what we called the skirmishes. And so these little skirmishes, although they didn't appear to be much, it could be disastrous as regards the outcome of it. Well, what had actually happened, the 15th Scottish had done a little local action at a village called St Martin, and they required a little bit of tank support. And what they'd done, they'd lent my troop from A Squadron, two troop from A Squadron, which was my old troop, and a troop from B Squadron. Well, I don't know about the B Squadron, but my troop was wiped out. And Jack Mann, who was my original sergeant, had been taken prisoner. The officer who I never knew had been killed. And Harvey Burrows, who was a corporal who'd taken my place, had also been killed. Now, whatever happened to the tank, my crew got out unhurt and got back. So the situation was that I could have my old crew back and carry on where I left off. Now, the reason I didn't know the officer was that after Goodwood, and we'd lost 52 tanks. The regiment obviously had to be reorganised. And so what the colonel had done, he'd rearranged the crews and the troops in the three squadrons. And so Mr Dolby, who had been my officer at Goodwood, had gone to B Squadron. And it had a funny sequel to that, because I didn't know that he'd done that at that time, so I assumed that this officer who'd been killed had been Mr. Dolby. In fact, Mr. Dolby wasn't killed until later down at Veer, but I didn't know that. Anyway, I was also under the impression he was killed at St. Martin, and there's a long story attached to that which I won't go into. But anyway, that's what had happened, so results of which I got my crew back again. Now, unfortunately, the driver, Bill Benmore, suffered with boils, and he had to go sick. So I lost Benny, and I had to have a new driver. So this new driver was a person I knew, but I never associated him with driving a Cromwell. So I said, "You're not a Cromwell driver." I said, "You was in carriers when we used to have a troop of carriers for recce, and we'd now gone over to Dingo Scout cars instead of carriers." I said, "You was in carriers." He said, "Yeah, but there's not much difference, Reg, is there?" I said, "There's a bloody lot of difference." I said, "You can't compare driving a carrier with a steering wheel," I said, "to a Cromwell with tillers and all that gear." I said, "You better show me you can drive it." So anyway, I gave him a little bit of a talking to, and he had to drive round. And unfortunately, when I saw Bill Bailey again, I said, "It's bloody useless." I said, "Haven't you got anybody else?" He said, "He's the only one." He said, "You'll have to have him." I said, "Oh, Christ." Anyway, it meant a bit of a problem for me as a tank commander, because although I did know, through being so many years from the Terrier days, virtually knowing every man's job and being capable of doing every man's job in the crew. But unfortunately, you don't want the responsibility of having to watch every man doing his job. You assume he's a trained man and you don't have to watch him. You can get on with doing your job, which is a tank commander. So I had the responsibility added to me of keeping an eye on this driver, who was pretty incompetent, and it had a disastrous result for us later on. Anyway, I got this new chap, and we carried on. Well, we then had a new troop, and I collected an officer named Mr. Rabbit and a troop sergeant named Tiffy Harris, who I knew both of them anyway from the old days, and we carried on from there, you see, and we went into Operation Bluecoat, which for the 2NY started on the 31st of July. Now, Bluecoat wasn't a short, sharp action that we'd done previously. I mean, an Epsom action for us lasted 5 days, and for Goodwood it lasted 2 days. But this was going to be virtually the finish of the Normandy campaign down to Falaise Gap, to finish the Falaise Gap. And so you're talking of about 2-3 weeks run into probably 4 weeks. So it was a prolonged action, not a short, sharp thing, and it was a series of going on from one thing to another thing to another thing, day by day, taking each day that it came, you see. Now, the situation as I, well, it seemed to me, I mean, I'm no historian, but it seemed to me that now that, what's name had been done, Goodwood, it seemed to me that the front line was now fairly straight across Normandy, from the left to the right. Now on the right, air right that was the Americans. Now the 11th Army Division was on the right of the line, going now from north to south, down to the Falaise Gap. And on our right was the Americans. Now, if you get two formations like that, especially different nationalities, there is a danger of having a gap between the two, which could be infiltrated by the enemy. So Pitt Roberts, the divisional commander, decided that he would operate his armoured division, his armoured brigade, plus the brigade, the 159 Infantry Brigade. They would work together, and he'd acquired a squadron from the Household Cavalry of armoured cars, which he would use as his reconnaissance for his division. And that, therefore, he was able to put us in the gap between the 11th Army Division and the left flank of the American forces. Well, when we started, we were on a very narrow front, regimentally, just filling this gap. It was like a slice of butter in between two slices of bread, as you might think. And so we were basically on a squadron, a front of a squadron strength. We were quite a narrow front. And C Squadron, who originally, as I remember, took the lead, they were in contact with the Americans on our right flank initially. But within 24 hours, we never ever saw the Americans again, although we were in the gap to keep this contact. Where they went, we don't know, but we never contacted Acton again. And so the war carried on. And after the first day, we motored down. C Squadron were taking the lead. B Squadron were supporting them and watching the flanks. And A Squadron, we were in reserve. Well, then the second day, of course, we'd widened our front, attempting to keep this contact between the 11th on the right, on the left, and the Americans on the right. And so our front was gradually expanding as we progressed forward in the fighting. And on the second day, we'd progressed to a two-squadron front, occupying more ground. And we were having little skirmishes, and not battles, but little skirmishes with these rearguard actions the German kept putting in, like with one Tiger or one Panther and a group of infantry or whatever. And you kept running into these little things, and consequently you probably lost a tank, but we never ever got involved heavily. It was just an odd tank, you see. Strange as it may seem, my squadron didn't seem to ever be, when they were taking the lead, ever seemed to run into these things, so we never lost any tanks. But B Squadron and C Squadron did occasionally lose some tanks, odd ones, perhaps two at the most, at any one time. And of course it was a bad time really for tanks, because we were now in the Bocards proper. And this is a terrible country for tanks to be in, because the tank commander is right up in the bushes, in the orchards, he can't see the ground, and if you get onto a road, you've got high banks that the guns can't even traverse across the grain. It's all, the tank commander's about the only one who can see above the banks. And the roads are so narrow that the tanks are not able to turn around anyway, because the tanks are longer and the roads are wider. And then you've got all these high banks with the hedgerow growing on the top. So you've already got to look for an opening, like a gate or something that the farmers use, or you've got to take the risk of going over the top of the bank, which means the belly of the tank is totally exposed to anybody with an anti-tank gun or somebody with what the German equivalent of a Piat, a Panzerfaust as they call them. And so you're quite likely to get something come up through the belly of the tank, which is not very thick, when you go over through the hedge, straight over the top of the bank, you see. Well, I personally did it all wrong, because normally what would happen, the leading tanks, they would look for these gaps and use a gap. And I thought, well, if I was an anti-tank gunner waiting for the enemy to come, I'd position my gun to initially fire at a gap that a tank would probably come through. It would mean also that if he chose not to come through that gap and chose to come over the top of the bank through the hedge, say 100 yards away, I've now got to move my gun sight right or left to accommodate that new position, hoping that from the tank man's point of view that he'd get his tank over before that gun could be retrained on his new position. So I always chose, as I say, to do the wrong thing. I always chose to go over the bank and through the hedge. I was constantly told several times by my troop officer or the sergeant or somebody else, saying, one of these times you'll go over that bank, you'll get one straight through your bloody belly. But it was noticeable to me that the ones that did get knocked out were usually the ones that went through the gaps. So anyway, that was my opinion, and we never got knocked out anyway, so that was that. And as I say, we progressed through this bocage, and I used to rely a lot on my driver and the co-driver, who could see probably more than I could see when we were amongst these bushes and the hedges and the orchards and things like that. And we had a little bit of a skirmish the regiment was involved in. There was some sort of a forest we ran into, but I don't think there was anything disastrous, and we carried on from that. Well, then something happened that had a big impact on the 11th Army Division. A troop from the Household Cavalry, as I understand it from reading books and talking to people, not from my own personal experience, a troop of this Household Cavalry got onto a road and got mixed up with a German convoy going south. And of course, when you appreciate by now, all vehicles are very filthy, they're knocked about, the mud guards are buckled up and all sorts of things, hardly recognisable as what they're supposed to look like. And of course, relying on the fact that the enemy didn't always know their own vehicles from air vehicles. Anyway, they travelled, it appears, quite a way with this convoy, but eventually managed to get out of it by shooting off down a sort of a side road. And unfortunately ran into some sort of an anti-tank gun situation or something, in which two of the cars were knocked out. But the officer, who was a name Dickie Prowse, I remember this because of the consequences of what happened. And the two cars that were left, the officer and another one, they carried on and eventually came to a bridge over a river. The river, as I say it, and it's spelt peculiarly, it's the River Solier. As I say it, if you read it, it'll probably make sense. Anyway, they arrived at this river with a bridge over, and a German on it, who I should imagine was like a DR, a solitary German, and probably like equivalent of our military police, who were simply there to give information for people coming through as to where the location of other German units were. But in the book it says they dealt with him, however, I don't know, but it just says they dealt with this single German, took up a position where they covered themselves, and reported back to the division that they were now sitting on a bridge, completely intact, unobserved by the Germans, and it was 6 miles in front of the units. So initially there's a bit of suspicion about whether it's a bit of a con from the Germans for some reason, or whether it's true. But eventually, through various means, Pip Roberts, the divisional commander, accepted as fact. And he looks at his map and realises that the bridges that they were making for at Beni Bocage, which was also going to be used by the Guards Army Division, where there was going to be a bit of a congestion, if this bridge was intact, it meant that he could transfer his division, the 11th Army Division, to use this bridge on its own entirely. So he knew that he'd got to get this bridge and keep it intact. So the nearest unit to it to support these two army cars was the 2nd North Ants Yeomanry. So two troops were dispatched immediately from C Squadron. I think it was Lieutenant Dyer was in charge, with a sergeant in charge of the other troop. It took them about 3 hours to make their way down this 6 miles, because they ran into a little bit of trouble, but fortunately overcame it, never lost any tanks. It took them about 3 hours to get to this bridge. And in our own history book, and the funny thing is, it says that they never ever saw the two armoured cars, which were already supposed to be there. But they took up positions and camouflaged themselves, I suppose. And the idea was not to interfere with the Germans who were using it, otherwise they would get suspicious. And the idea then was that the pit robbers got a squadron from the 23rd Hussars carrying infantry to go down and then enlarge the situation in defence. But anyway, the outcome of it was that it appears in the books that the 11th Army Division was switched in its line of march, as we used to call it, from going straight on off to the right, and apparently the 11th Army Division progressed so fast because of this bridge that they could use that they completely outstripped, as I say, the Americans we'd lost sight of anyway on the right, and they completely outstripped the Guards Army Division, who apparently were on the left of the 11th, and the division immediately was pressing on because Pitt Roberts was a pusher anyway. And this is from then on that the trouble for the 2nd NY started. By now we got up to August the 2nd and we were getting down to towards a town called Via, which is a town proper. And our centre line for the 2nd Yeomanry was the main road which ran from Caen to Via. And about 8 miles up the main road was a place, like a village more or less, called La Bista. Well, RHQ set up their position there, took their that as their headquarters. And C Squadron, the situation then, the colonel set the regiment out, the three squadrons, with C Squadron on the right flank, B Squadron in the centre, operating down the main road and the country to the left of it, between La Bista and Via, and A Squadron to the left of B Squadron, and then our troop of recce troop of army cars, which was the Dingo Scout cars, were between A Squadron and the 159 Infantry Brigade, so we had a contact with them on the left. But having no infantry with us, you can imagine we'd got 60 odd tanks spread about the countryside, and we were now on a front from Via to the 159 Infantry Brigade, probably 5 miles, 6 miles, something like that. Covering this, you've got A Squadron and sort of two-thirds of B Squadron. Now, from the main road to Via, there was a main road runs up about a mile and a half above Via at a place called Le Papillon. It's just a village. And it's a main road that runs off, and it goes up through a town called Etterby. Now, C Squadron had sent patrols out, and they'd found out that the town of Etterby was occupied by the Germans. It was actually one of the American objectives, but they hadn't reached it yet, and the Germans were still in charge of it. Now, geographically, from La Bista, there was a road ran off to the right, directly to Etterby. So C Squadron then were given the job of guarding that road, so that was the right flank of RHQ, and this road from Etterby down to the point where it joined the main road just above Via was sort of given as the front line for C Squadron to patrol. They did not supposed to go beyond that, you see. So they were sort of guarding a triangle from HQ to Etterby, down the road to Le Papillon, and on the left of them would be the main road from La Bista to Via, which B Squadron were in charge of. Well, an unfortunate thing happened, because all that day we've been having it quite cushy. Nobody was bothering us. A Squadron, we'd gone down, there's a main railway line runs from Via to Vassy, and a main road that runs from Via to Vassy. And A Squadron had crossed the railway and were now overlooking this main road and reporting back everything we could see and not bothering anybody, so that as far as the Germans were concerned, they didn't know we were there. Now, C Squadron did a silly thing, because when you get recce units, and we were officially a recce unit, you have boundaries up to which you operate and confirm that they are in good order according to what you expect to find. But having reached these joint where the main road from down at Papillon that came from Etave joined the Via Road, they were down there and thought, well, things are so calm and nobody about, they, two of their troops went into Via town itself. Now, they contacted the local Maki people, these resistance people and all that. They contacted them, who by now were becoming very active. And they informed them that their Via was virtually a clear town, that the only troops, German troops in there were more or less echelon and administrative people. There were no fighting men, as you might say, not in strength in any case, not in strength enough to be bothered about. So that was what the report went back to DivHQ and to RRHQ, that Via was an open town. Well, the results about of these two troops going into Via and then withdrawing in a normal way because they were getting towards the end of the day, the result of that was that the Germans by now, the same as us, knew what enemy forces, divisional, regimental signs and things were. And the Black Bull, as I read from other books, had become very prominently known to the Germans as a pushing division. Pitt Roberts, being an old desert man, the Germans reckon, I mean, they would know who he was, who was running the division. They know all that sort of information. So when suddenly two troops of Cromwell's turn up in Via, as far as the German authorities were concerned, the second Northamptonshire Yeomanry are the heavy armoured reconnaissance regiment for the 11th Armoured Division. They would assume that if the tanks of the Yeomanry were in Via, the division would be somewhere behind them. In fact, the division wasn't behind us at all. It was off on their left rear. But the Germans didn't know that. They also didn't know what other forces might be there, but they reacted very strongly. And from somewhere, they sorted out about 20 Tigers. And before it got dark, they sent a patrol up the road and knocked out the leading troop of B Squadron. And the night settled down to sort of scattered action, infiltration by German infantry and things like that. The consequence was that we had to pull our horns in, and A Squadron had been withdrawn back from the road, back over the railway, and shortened their position. B Squadron had been pulled back, and sort of two-thirds of them were on the right of A Squadron, and the right hand and the main road, which they'd given their responsibility. And C Squadron were now looking after the protection of HQ and watching the right flank, where it appeared there was no trouble coming from. Although Etave was occupied by the Germans, it didn't seem as though they were doing any probing to find out where we were. And the night settled down, and we had a bit of skirmishing during the night, but the 3rd of August, and the night of the 3rd of August, and the early hours of the 4th of August, were a total disaster for the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. Through the 3rd, and through the night, and the morning of the 4th, we were infiltrated by German Tigers on all flanks and the front, everywhere. They seemed to be all over the place. Panzer Grenadiers, and it turned out afterwards, elements of the German 3rd Parachute Division were all involved, and the only people there was the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. Obviously, the Germans had been anticipating something far greater in that area than what we were. The result was that by the morning of the 5th of August, the action was finished, because it appears from the books that the Germans had attained all their objectives, the main one being La Bista, where they got into La Bista and shot up our RHQ. They totally decimated RHQ. The MOs half track and all sorts of people were killed. And we finished up with 14 tanks. It appears that Major Courage, who was a senior squadron leader, took over and formed a composite squadron of 14 tanks from what was left of the regiment. And RHQ had been totally chopped up, and that was the situation of the regiment. And for myself, I was in a total disaster area, because this driver that I'd got, as I say, he could not control a Cromwell. Now, a Cromwell has an aeroplane engine in it, which is a Meteor, and it is the same engine that's adapted from the Spitfire and the Lancaster bombers. Now, the one thing about these engines is that they must not, for any length of time, run lower than 400 revs a minute. Otherwise, the fuel is not used in the cylinders, and the cylinders shut up, and eventually the engine seizes up. And I'd been constantly telling this driver to rev his engine up, to keep his revs up, because he, not having done a course on a Cromwell, and not being a proficient driver anyway, somehow or other, the fact didn't penetrate his tiny brain of this one factor, that when we were stationary, he must keep his revs up above 400 revs. And I was constantly telling him, get them bloody revs up. And he'd say, oh, all right, Reg, because he knew me. He said, all right, Reg. And he'd sort of tickle his accelerator. And up until now, he was always lucky enough to clear the cylinders. And she was splutter and splutter, and blah, 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 blah. You know what aeroplane engines do when they're ticking over. And then suddenly she got a terrific roar, and when the cylinders cleared, and all sorts of rubbish had come out the back of the exhaust and clouds of smoke. And then as long as he kept his revs up again, we were sort of back on even keel. But with all this fighting going on, this infiltration, I was so occupied with survival that I neglected to keep telling this driver to watch his revs. And the consequence was that when the situation was so desperate that the squadron leader, that was Major Sandy Saunders, came up and ordered A squadron to withdraw about 2,000 yards. That would have normally created a gap between the infiltrating Germans and ourselves, because, I mean, if you get a Cromwell, you turn, even in the dark, which it was the night of the 3rd of August, and all they did, they simply turned around and motored off, and in the dark, they're still probably 15, 20 mile an hour, and that would, no infantry could keep up with that, so you'd immediately have a gap, so that you could reorganise yourself, sort yourself out, and prepare for further action. Well, by now, my tank was reduced to a walking pace. Now, the fitters, Bill Staunton, who was the sergeant fitter, had initially intended to come down and replace all the plugs and injectors in the engine and clean the carburetors out. But when the balloon went up, he said, the best I can do, Reg, he said, is to come down with the recovery and tow you out. But the Germans infiltrated to such an extent that the fittest truck and everything was all brewed up by the Germans at RHQ in Echelon. They were totally shot up in every way, that I was abandoned virtually, because when my troop officer and the troop sergeant was going to pull back, he said, what are you going to do about it? So I said, well, there's only one thing we can do. I said, well, hang on, in case Bill Staunton comes down. And failing that, I said, well, let them make other arrangements. So they didn't abandon us deliberately, but they moved back as per orders. So we were left there on our own. And we're sitting in the tank that could, we could walk as fast as the tank. And the noise it made trying to do that, you'd have heard it off a miles away. So we sat there with the engine switched off, having to make our minds up what to do. So we had a bit of a chat, and when I talk like this about a bit of a chat, you think, well, why should you have a chat? Surely the tank commander just said what to do and you'd do it. But a tank crew is a little family, you see, so and you're all mates, so you're not dogmatic about what you're going to do. Not very often. The tank commander is just part of the crew, and he's always got to be prepared to take advice from the lads. So we had a bit of a chat, and I said, well, it's obvious, I said, Bill Staunton's never going to come down now. I said, so the only thing is, I said, what do we do? Do we sit it out or walk back? I said, well, that's the only thing we can do. So having decided that we'd walk back, we then did disable the tank to our best ability, and consequence of which I had a rocket off of the second in command later on, because I didn't destroy my tank. Now, the method of destroying a Cromwell was quite simple. You took the top, the cap off one of the petrol tanks, because you had two petrol tanks in the one each side of the engine. Got big filler caps, you see, so you just took the cover, took the filler cap off, got the hand grenade in, and just walked away. And that was the end of the tank. It had just simply blow up and burn. But I thought, well, it only wants some new plugs, and the carburetor's cleaning. If we can't move it, I don't think the Germans are going to be in a situation to...